I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sports ad free. That's amazon.com/sports ad free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Renee, it's my favorite time of the year. It's clay court season.
We know how excited you get about that red stuff.
You get excited about the red stuff too. Come on.
Yeah, I mean, I do. I do enjoy watching tennis on clay a lot. I just think the variety of shots, the drop shots, the sliding. I was never a fan, as far as my results were concerned, on clay, just because it really requires patience to be a great clay court player and sort of waiting for the right shot. But I love playing on clay because I loved to slide. So that in itself, really, I enjoyed it, especially Paris. There's nothing like the clay in Paris, Caitlin. You play like through the season, you know, Rome and Madrid and all the courts are beautiful, right? But then all of a sudden you turn up in Paris and you step onto the courts there at Roland Garros and the courts are just, I don't know what they do. I don't know how they treat them better, but they just are so much better than everywhere else in the world. And it's just always a pleasure. So that's, yeah, I do like the clay too.
I am shocked constantly because we, the racket team, tends to attract a mix of people who have maybe grown up playing tennis and a few super fans, but a lot of people who haven't really spent a lot of time on court. And I'm always shocked to hear that people have never really played on clay before, if especially if they're like kind of on the more recreational side of the sport. And I tell them like, oh my God, it's only going to get better. Like if you've only played on hard court, that's the worst version of tennis. Like clay tennis is amazing to play. I mean, I love grass too, but it's a little harder to find. But clay court tennis, it's so easy on your body. It's fun to slide. You know, if you can find some red clay courts, which, you know, we actually have some here in New York, you know, you're not going to get much better of an experience playing. And, you know, despite the fact that it was not, it was the only Grand Slam that you never won.
Thanks. Just rub that in.
Well, the fact that you won every other one is, you know, no one will ever take that away from you. But I also feel like the French Tennis Federation is so difficult. The French Open is always doing its own thing. And yet we love it because it's so persnickety. You know what I mean?
Persnickety. Yeah. Well, I made the finals of mixed and doubles there.
Yes.
So I wasn't a complete boob on it. And I won the Italian Open in doubles. So I wasn't a complete, like, you know, as I said, I really liked to play on clay. And it was just the way that you had to play doubles on clay was a little bit different. You had to really be, as I said, a little bit more strategic with the way you hit your volley, and it really pushed me to be better. And also being a serve and volleyer, playing on clay was a little bit more difficult because you didn't quite have that footing at the net that you did on any other surface. But
what was it like to win the Italian Open? I mean, that to me, looking at the Forza Italia, like that's the most beautiful tennis court in all of the world.
It was great. Yeah, Lisa and I beat a girl called Maui Serna and Arantxa Santos Vicario in the
I've
final.
I've heard of her.
Yeah, you've heard of her. Oh, well, Maui's great. Serna was a great player. She was a lefty, super, 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 ultra talented. You know, was a good player in her day, like very good singles player and very good doubles player. And so that was a lot of fun to win that tournament. Yeah. I mean, it was great. Yeah, that court is so cool. It's like you really feel like you're a bit of a gladiator when you walk in there. It's very
totally
cool.
It's covered with, you know, those Mussolini era, like Olympian statues, like they've just, you know, sort of ambled down from Mount Olympus. It's really cool. It's breathtaking. I've never been to the tournament and I would like to go very, very much. That seems like a fun one to visit. I love the clay season. I just love having the red on my screen in the background. It's always like during this part of the year where it's a little warmer in Southern Europe. So you kind of wish you were there, because in New York, it's still clinging to colder temperatures. You know, it's like the whole, I get really swept up in the sort of like emotion of the clay court season. I think that's why I like it so much.
Yeah. No, anyway, moving on.
Well, we should get in today's interview, but before we do, I feel like we should address something that is looking a little bit farther ahead, but that has been on everybody's mind, which is grass court season, but mostly Wimbledon, the All England Lawn Tennis Club, and their current decision, and I call it current because it might change, their current decision to ban Russian and Belarusian players from playing this year's tournament, which has caused obviously a lot of controversy. A lot of people have come out against it, saying that it sort of penalizes the players unfairly who don't even seem to have direct ties to Putin. On the other hand, people, you know, are sort of saying, you know, if we don't make a case out of every, you know, every corner of the world that Putin has his tender hooks into, then we're missing an opportunity to make a big statement about what is clearly an atrocity going on in Ukraine. LTA and Wimbledon are on one side, and as well as some, you know, former players. Pam Shriver has come out in support of the ban, as has, you know, the royal family seems to be keen to support it. But the ATP and WTA on the other side, and some of the players are saying, like, this is a, you know, unfair. It's a boondoggle. What do you think? What's on your mind when you look at something like that?
Well, you know me, Caitlin. I tend to not be too ambiguous with my decision making. No. But I will say this situation really, honestly, I'm a little perplexed with it. I mean, I'm just sad overall about the whole thing, to be quite honest. I mean, obviously, what's happening in Ukraine, a country I've been to, is just, it's horrific. It's absolutely horrific. And I just have no words for what that country and the families and people and all the players on tour. And I've spoken to many of them about, you know, the predicaments that they've been in, and just, you know, their fathers still being there. It's just horrendous. I do feel sorry for the Russian players in some respect, because obviously I know a bunch of them and I know that they would never be okay with this war. But, you know, the flip side is, look, I've spoken, as I said, to some Ukraine players, and you know, they one in particular I spoke to was a little upset that the Russian players didn't come up to them or her personally. I'm not going to tell you who it was, because, you know, I don't want to get into all of that, but she said, you know, one of the things that upset her was that they did not come to, a lot of the Russian players did not come to her just to sort of say something to her, whether it just be, look, I'm really sorry, I can't say anything publicly because, you know, this guy's crazy, he could kill my family, he could, you know, make my life a nightmare in the future. But I can't say anything publicly, but privately, can I just tell you, this is how I feel. Mm-hmm. And I think the Ukraine players would have been a little bit supportive of not banning them at Wimbledon if they'd been more supportive of them privately. Even maybe to go as far as to talk to the All England Club and say, listen, they have come to us, approached us, and we feel badly for them because they've come to us privately. They can't say anything publicly. So I don't know. I oscillate back and forth. I feel, because as I said, there are some players from Russia that I know are just appalled by this, but they can't. They really feel badly. And Putin really uses sports athletes to promote his propaganda, and that is just a fact. I mean, he had those Russian athletes and won gold medals and medals at the Olympics up on the stage when he had that, what the hell, whatever that was, at Trump rally in Moscow. And that is a concern, because he does use sports athletes to propagate, and, you know, to use his propaganda around the world, and especially to his Russian people. So I don't know. I'm caught between a hot rock and a hard place with this one. I really feel badly for some of the Russian players, but I think it's a statement maybe that tennis needs to make. I don't know. I honestly don't, Caitlin.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's, you know, our friend Craig Shapiro on his podcast had an interview with Alexander Dolgopolov. He's talked to a couple other Ukrainians, Sergei Stakovsky, who like went back home and enlisted for a time. You know, it's really heartrending, you know, obviously hearing about players who are trying to compete on an international circuit, but also having the lives of their families, you know, some of whom have been like, I remember Yastremka's family at one point was living in a garage, you know, it's just, it's you know, absolutely horrific. You know, and obviously I don't think there are many players from what I understand, you know, I'm thinking specifically about Rublev writing No War, you know, in support of peace, which to me felt like a very radical statement, on a camera after one of his wins right after the war had started. You know, I don't know how realistic it is to think that these players are going to speak out. You know, to me, I think taking international incidents, you know, I believe that sports and politics are inextricably interlinked, but I don't know that players themselves banning the teams, absolutely, which is what tennis has done and a number of other sports have done. Obviously, we have seen the Belarusian and Russian teams not able to compete in team competitions, which to me seems right. You know, banning individual players, many of whom don't even live in Russia, feels strange. It feels like a loyalty test. And it also sort of opens up a whole other can of worms, which is to say, you know, in 2005, when America was conducting an illegal war in Iraq, was Andy Roddick or Venus Williams or, you know, Lance Armstrong banned from international competition?
Well,
you know,
like,
or trying to disappear to play. Lance should have been for other reasons, but, you know, are we banning Chinese athletes for an autocratic Chinese government? You know, and the fact that they disappeared a WTA player under our noses, you know, I for me, it's more, if you want to go after Russia, take all the Russian money out of tennis, donate all of the proceeds to Ukraine, make the oligarchs who have access to your fancy clubs and your fancy cars and their fancy yachts and your fancy schools like Oxford and Cambridge. And I kind of am limiting this to Britain because I think the US has frankly done a better job. And has less of its hands dirty on this particular issue with Russian money than Britain has, which is why this strikes me as being very performative without being, you know, having much substance. But yeah, I agree with you. It's a tough situation all around, and it's just sort of sad. And, you know, and the reason I said it was a current decision is, you know, we'll see whether it, you know, whether it stands after all this blowback from a lot of international bodies. But I do think like other tournaments are going to be looking to Wimbledon to sort of set the tone. The Italian Open reportedly has been looking at a similar ban. I don't know if the US Open plans to do that. I just think, I think banning people for loyalty pledges is a pretty bad precedent. But I do agree that, you know, anytime the sporting world can demonstrate how wonderful it is to have players from all sorts of places setting aside their differences and coming together in celebration of sport, you're kind of thumbing your nose at any autocrat by having, you know, the power of uniting us rather than dividing us being evident. So yeah, it felt like addressing just because it's been on the minds of everybody in the tennis world, and it doesn't seem like it's going to go away.
Yeah, I mean the WTA ATP, I'm sure they're talking about what they can do about it, because I think they feel a responsibility to protect the players individually. But I know that they're also hearing it from the players from Ukraine, you know, and what are you guys going to do about it kind of thing. But as I said, they're looking at maybe taking points away from Wimbledon. And if they do that, it'll become a very glorified exhibition. But having said that, if I won Wimbledon this year without points and they told me I wasn't getting points when they gave me that trophy, I probably wouldn't care too much.
Yeah, you'd still put the trophy in your trophy case, you know? I'd still probably make out with a Venus Rosewater dish in front of a, you know, a crowd of a couple million people. So, yeah, I totally take your point.
I don't know. As I said, I think overall, my take on this is it's just very, very sad. That's how I feel.
I'm just disappointed that it looks like Medvedev, who's like one of the few people who can, you know, who hasn't hit his stride on grass, might be denied the chance to play it. Like watching him get to the finals would be extremely fun, especially because it looks like, you know, the real changing of the guard has already happened, at least on the sort of like clay specialist side of the men's tour. You know what I mean?
But I mean, and also Sabalenka, who made the semifinals there last year. I mean, oof,
she's has a ton of titles on grass. Not a ton, but she's got grass titles. Like she's a real contender on the grass.
Well, how are they going to? Yeah, and I'm thinking how are the WTA going to manage that? Are they just going to let her points drop off because she couldn't play? So that's a lot of points. Semifinals is a lot of points to drop off. So it'll be interesting to see how they handle that in particular. Situation, because she's going to drop a lot in the rankings because of it, and not really any fault of her own except for the flag that's next to her name. I tell you what, tell you who's happy. All the Russian players that left Russia and decided to represent Uzbekistan
right.
and Kazakhstan.
I mean, per usual, Yulia Putintseva has the last laugh, you know?
You might think she's crazy, but she's really not.
Crazy like a fox.
Exactly.
All right. Well, speaking of people who are very smart, I am delighted that you were able to sit down with Jenny Brady, who is a phenomenal American player who's had a similar sort of semifinal and final showings at slams in the last couple of years, has been sidelined by injuries, which she's working her way back from at the moment. But I'm talking about, of course, Jennifer Brady, a UCLA player, a college educated player, a humble kid from Pennsylvania, as far as I can tell. Give me a sense of how Jenny's sort of seen on the tour. Obviously, she's a beast on the court, but it's interesting getting into her personality a little bit, as you guys do. How's she seen, and how do other players sort of think about her?
Oh, she's the best. I mean, there's certain players that would sort of walk around and you can't not like them. And that is for sure Jen Brady. I mean, she's just constantly always in a like fun, loving mood, always making fun of herself, always, you know, joking around, finding humor in most everything. So she's a bit of a dichotomy as a human being, though, and we discussed that a lot on the pod. But she's just a joy to be around. It was such a bummer. She was having such a great like 12 months making, as you said, that US Open semifinal against Osaka, where she played, in my opinion, that was the best match of the tournament that year. Yeah. And then, of course, made the finals of the Australian Open. And we get into sort of the mindset of, you know, being in a final as opposed to a semifinal and all this sort of stuff in the pod. But she's such a talent. I cannot wait to have her back on tour. She went through, obviously, you know, disaster with the injuries with, you know, her feet and plantar fascia, and then got into a knee issue. You know, I sort of put a little bit of blame on her ex-coach, because I just have to think that Jenny's that type of person that doesn't need to be pushed. And, you know, she kept pushing herself, and you know, he's a hard worker as well. And I think that's where maybe some issues had to have cropped up, because she just, you know, is that you don't need to push her. Mm-hmm. And as a coach, you need to recognize, is my player a little lazy? And there are players out in the tour that you kind of need to push a little bit more, like, oh, let's do a half an hour more, or maybe get into the gym a little bit more. And some you never have to do that with. And I won't name a couple that I think are a little bit lazy, but certainly Jen Brady doesn't.
Yeah, I feel like I'm in the second category. If I had a coach, I'd need somebody to get on my ass. Like, get out of bed, do more. Yeah. Blah, blah, blah. You know, like my coach was always like, you're off. Our physical trainer would be like, you've been on the elliptical for 5 minutes. And I'm like, are you sure it hasn't been 45 minutes? You know what I mean? you don't strike me as one of those types, you know?
No. Well, yeah, I mean, me in the gym, if I had a little issue with something, you know, if I said to my trainer, oh, my calf feels a bit sore, oh, we're stopping, boom, you know, because he just knew not to push me if I was.
You could push yourself. You were never going to make excuses. But if something came up, it was because you were really aware of something maybe that was going to be a problem.
Well, yeah. And I mean, I was fragile, Caitlin. I mean, just fragile. But no, so I think with Jenny, I mean, that was kind of the issue. She kept playing through the pain, and she needed to shut it down earlier. But, you know, the retrospect of her career is that she had the smarts to go to college and realize that she wasn't quite ready to be a pro, you know, maturity-wise and also game-wise. But in this respect, she kind of blew it with the injuries and really kept pushing through and needed to have people around her sort of saying no. But hey, listen, mistakes get made. Players make these stupid mistakes all the time with injuries and, you know, push through them too much, and she paid the price. So hopefully when she comes back, she's going to be a threat. And I really hope that she continues to believe in herself in every aspect, because in my mind, she is as good as they come, and there's no doubt she can win a Grand Slam. I mean, she has a very similar game to someone like Ash, where she hits a great first and second serve. She has a massive forehand. Her backhand is excellent. I think she could like even get her slice a little better. I think that will set her up more. I mean, we saw how much that helped Ash Barty in her career with the slice, how much players hated it. And, you know, she can play at the net. So she's a terrific athlete, moves around the court as well as anybody. So let's hope when she gets back, we see the old Jenny Brady back in a hurry, because we need her. She's such a great player, especially in American tennis.
100%. The tour is better with her on it. It was really funny when we hosted a party at a Racquet House last year, late in Beverly Hills, and both Australian Open finalists Naomi Osaka and Jen Brady were both playing ping pong back to back on separate ping pong tables. And it was just sort of funny to see the two of them, who I think would both be safely described as introverts, at a massive party, really finding a friendly space at the ping pong table. So it was sort of nice to make them feel like they obviously were welcome in the racket universe. And it was great to hear Jenny talk. So without further ado, I'll get to it. Thank you, Jenny Brady. We're happy you're on your way back. And I agree. The tennis world is better with her in it, healthy, playing well. Here's to having a swift recovery.
Yeah. And just for everybody, the photo that you will see on this pod is her playing ping pong at that party with her boot on. So anyway, is it Jenny or Jennifer? Either way, Caitlin, here you go.
All right, well, let's get stuck into this. Jenny Brady, first of all, thanks for joining me on the pod. And it's great to see you. I know people aren't going to see you, but they're going to hear your voice finally for the first time in a long time. But firstly, before we get to where you've been and what's been going on over the last year or so, I always ask my guests, why tennis? Like, why and how did you get into tennis?
Oh, that's a good question. Well, nobody in my family played tennis. My dad played sports growing up. He played football. So he kind of was the one who got me into it. One day he took my sister and I to the courts and we just started playing there. And then eventually, I guess, he started putting me in lessons. And then my whole family, we ended up moving to Florida, not just for tennis, but it also ended up helping because there's more, it's more competitive here than in Pennsylvania. So, and then I started to grow from just playing at a local park to then being in an academy at Everett and then just kind of progressing from there. But I think my parents always told me that when I was younger, I liked playing, this is going to sound weird, but I always had a ball in my hand, like whether it was a football, basketball, baseball, tennis ball, something like, and I like playing with balls. Okay. So my parents told me that I always just playing sports, and I guess just from a young age, like being somewhat decent at tennis, and then they kind of just instilled it in me.
It's that's interesting because you're a little bit of a dichotomy as a human being, because I find you to be, so first of all, you're one of the easiest person to ever be around. You're one of the most liked players on tour. You're always funny. You're totally taking jabs at yourself all the time. But yet it's a solitary sport, tennis, and you're more sort of like a team type of person in some respects, but yet you are quite a shy person. So it's kind of like you're this interesting person to pick tennis, but yet was that tough for you? Or because your dad played a different sport, were you interested in any other sport?
No, I was never really interested in another sport competitively. I mean, I always just played other sports outside of tennis practice. And
till what age? Like, because
up until I was probably 15, 16 years old, I was always just playing, not competitively, but just for fun, always playing sports with my neighbors, with other boys. And I was a bit of a tomboy growing up, and yeah, it was just always outside doing something active. It is interesting because I do love being on a team. Like, I love the camaraderie. I love shooting the shit. So anytime, even just in the locker room with players, I seek out people just to go and kind of, bother them. And tennis is very individual. And that's also something that I do enjoy too, because like you said, I am shy, and I enjoy just being out there on my own and no one telling me what to do, and just being free and not having to answer to anyone or take advice or anything from anyone. Yeah.
Yeah. I always try and ask, fellow players or, anyone who's been successful, certainly in sports, about how important it is to not individualize so early sometimes. And if you're a good athlete, like you are, parents need to hear that sometimes. You don't want to individualize your your kid too early if they're a good sports athlete. And it sounds like that's sort of the route that you went with your tennis.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, going to an academy definitely helped. I think just having other people there. I can understand how people can get burnt out at a young age. I mean, it's really tough, just like all the travel, you know, just grinding at challengers, doing all that sort of stuff on your own. It can be very, very challenging.
What would you tell a kid then, before we get to sort of like why you went to college, but what would you tell a kid, you know, about that sort of grind and how important it is to hang in there?
Yeah, I mean, it's really important to hang in there. And I think there's other players, not that you have to like go and be best friends with everyone, but there's always at least another player that, you know, is looking for someone to hang out with or just spend time with outside of the court. So I think it's also important to, yeah, they're not going to be, you know, they're also your competitors, but they can also be your friends at the same time. So it's kind of finding that balance of, okay, yes, when we step on the court, like we're out for blood and both of us want to win. So it's not being you know, being soft on them. Oh, I feel bad if I beat them. No, like, cause they want the same thing. So I think it's important to find at least people or just someone to kind of keep you going, because it's really, really tough if you're alone. I mean, when I was playing challengers and stuff, just coming up, I loved it because I was always sharing a room with like two girls, one girl, something. There was always somebody for me to just hang out with and pass time. So, and we were always just, you know, in it complaining together. So it's not easy, and just know that it's not going to be easy. It's not going to be, you know, it's not going to be glamorous. There's going to be times where you're staying at the Red Roof Inn or Econo Lodge and you hear mice and in the, you know, just running around. So, but you go through that and everybody goes through it to then, you know, put yourself in the position of playing Grand Slams and traveling to nicer tournaments.
Yeah, it's funny because, you know, everyone sees these big checks that everyone makes, you know, and I do air quotes right now, like huge checks. But what they don't see is all the shit that goes on prior to getting to even a reasonably big tournament, like a 125 is like, I'm making it now, you know, but they don't see you playing fives and 10,000s in the middle of nowhere, Texas, or in the middle of nowhere, Pennsylvania. Well, yeah. Right.
Yeah.
So was that what was the catalyst to go to college for you? Because some, and I also stress this to parents, you know, and I hope some parents listen to this podcast, is like, if your kid is not necessarily prepared to really go out there, and it's the grind in the challenges, but it's also a grind on tour. So what was your reasoning to go to college as opposed to going straight pro?
Yeah, I didn't really have the results that my other peers had. You know, I think Maddie at the age of 14 was already playing professional tournaments, winning matches, and I was still maybe grinding in grade four ITFs, losing first or second round. And I did have a good like couple of runs in like Orange Bowl Eddie Hearn doubles. So my junior ranking was solidified solely on doubles.
Don't knock it, man.
Knocking it. I'm saying it helped me. It helped me for sure. I mean, to be honest, I just didn't have the results. I didn't have the results. I didn't have the confidence. There was no reason whatsoever for me to go pro. The only thing was that I was training with these other players that were already turning pro, and I was probably the only one in my age group in the 95s that were you know, looking to go to college. And I felt like a little bit of a failure because everybody else was turning pro and, you know, signing some deals with sponsors and stuff like that. But yeah, I was excited to go to college. And when I went there, I was planning on going all 4 years, and I didn't know what I was going to do, to be honest with you. I didn't say, okay, I'm going to go for 1 year and then I'm going to turn pro and try it out. I was like, okay, I'm going to school. I never was the type of person to plan ahead. I always just, you know, live life as, you know, day-to-day basis, and never thought about playing professionally. You know, never thought about what it was going to be like in the real world if I didn't play. I just went to school and enjoyed it. And, yeah, that was my reason.
You told me back a while ago that basically Stella Sampras, who was your coach at UCLA, of course, if people have been born like maybe yesterday, don't know that Stella Sampras is Pete Sampras' sister. You told me that she kind of had to push you out the door. Like, Jen, you got this, go. Did you believe her when she was telling you that?
Yeah, both her and Rance. And also at the time, like my freshman year, our volunteer assistant, Laura Gordon, they were just like telling me, I mean, I played three in the lineup. I played
one and two.
I played a couple matches at two, but I played primarily number three. Robin Anderson was one, Chanel Van Wyn, Kyle McPhillips, they were around two. But yeah, I ended up getting a foot injury and I told Stella to put me at like four or five because I was like, let's win NCAAs again. So I didn't care about the lineup. I just wanted to win the natty. But yeah, they all just kind of not treated me differently, but you know, I felt like, okay, I am like a pretty good tennis player. And I think like I was seeing, you know, other players doing well at tournaments, like around Miami Open, Indian Wells. It was around that time when I was still in school and, you know, I was going to class and they were in the third round and I was like, oh God, I wish I was playing. And so something inside me was like, all right, I need to work harder, do some stuff on my own. And they totally supported me. And I actually ended up after my freshman year, I was playing some tournaments over the summer, like 25Ks, 50Ks, just like all the challengers in the US, and ended up doing pretty good and got my ranking up to like 220. And I was like, okay, do I go pro? Like, do I keep playing or do I go back to school? And, you know, I talked to Stella and it was a decision that I decided to go back. And then, you know, UCLA would honor my scholarship so I could go back and return anytime and they'll pay for my tuition. So I was like, okay, what's four more months? And then when I leave, I'll have a ranking and then I can play. So yeah, that was the reason why I left after my second year.
I think the key to that when I hear that story from you is also for parents and for kids that go to college or think about going to college or not, is just, you know, really be honest with yourself, like deep down inside, because first of all, college is tough. Like you've got a lot of hours on court, you're doing your schoolwork. It's not a walk in the park. It's a little bit of fun too. But I would say like turning pro, it's like that's it. You're pro, this is your profession now. So now you have to put everything into that basket. And like, this can be a little bit scary. So I'm glad you did it though.
Yeah. It definitely was a little bit scary in the beginning. I was like, I don't know if I could do this. And yeah, it wasn't easy, like I said before, but nothing's easy. And I was like, what am I going to do? Like sit behind a desk and work, you know? I was like, no way.
That's not you again. No way.
No.
So you know, cut to, you're going into the pros, you sort of get your feet wet, you're starting to develop your game a little bit. I guess, what was sort of the catalyst to like push you? Obviously, you changed coaches, you got away from the USTA system, you went to Germany, you got a different coach, he gave you a different mentality. But what are the things that like you felt like changed in that 6 month period where you really, you know, I saw you qualify in China, you had a great year the next year. What mentally changed? Because I saw a little bit of a different person from you from that period on to making the Australian Open final.
Oh yeah. The whole time I'd been playing since I left college, I was always just, not necessarily going through the motions, but like when I would play matches, like 1 year I played Simona Halep in Toronto and, I lost in three sets. It was a close three set match, but the whole time I never believed that I would win. Like I never believed that I could win the match. I always was just kind of quotes satisfied that I would get a set off of, you know, a top 20 player or a top 10 player. So I never actually believed that I could be that player, that I could be the one, you know, where someone was playing against me and I was the one who was seeded or I was the one going into the match being the favorite. I was always just used to being the underdog and being okay with having a tough loss. So I think my mentality changed when I started seeing and realizing that, you know, I have the game, I have the tools, I have what it takes to beat these players. And they're just people, like they're not, you know, they're not God, like they're just people like I am. And they also make mistakes and they're not perfect. So I always just put the players who were, you know, ranked maybe inside the top 50, always just on a pedestal. And, you know, after maybe getting a win or two, I was like, holy shit, like, that's me. Like, I'm better than that. You know, I can take it all the way. And then the results started coming. I started working a lot harder. I started believing in myself. And yeah, I think that's kind of how it started.
I talk about this all the time, Jen. It's about like, it's the subconscious mind and the conscious mind. And the conscious mind is the thing that you talk about, you say in press or you say to yourself, but then there's that little tiny Jenny in the back of the brain, or me, it used to be the little tiny Stubbsy in the back of my brain going, yeah, but you're not really quite ready yet. You know, I don't think you can win this match yet. And then all of a sudden, when the conscious mind and the subconscious mind are on the same page and they actually believe that they can win, that's when your life starts to change as a professional. So that's what it sounded like for you a little bit there. Because I have a funny story to tell, because we all know, you know, me doing courtside at ESPN, and it was one of your bigger matches. I think it was the third round of the US Open against Pliskova.
Fourth round.
Sorry, I should have had that correct. You know, way to go, Renee, way to get your research right. Fourth round. You're sitting there, it's the biggest match of your career at that point. You run out, you've got the wrong like M signage or whatever on your shirt. The umpire tells you, you got to go run off the court. Can you take me through that little 5-minute stint there and explain to people, this is one of the reasons why maybe things changed a little bit, because I think you were still a little bit like, what the hell am I doing out here? Tell me that story, please.
Yeah, I can actually tell you a little bit more to that story even before I went out to the court.
Great.
So I was warming up in the gym in Ash, and I'm first on at 11, and all of the courts were being called 10 minutes before. So at 10:50, I stop my warm up, I go downstairs, and I'm there waiting, and you're there too. And you're like, what are you doing here? You're like, you still have about like 12 minutes. And I'm like, what? I'm like, oh my gosh, I'm already warmed up. I'm ready to go. And I'm like, what do I do now? And I literally just go into the locker room and I sit on the bench for like 10, 12 minutes until one of the supervisors comes in and is like, okay, are you ready? And I'm like, oh yeah, I guess. I mean, I've been ready for 15 minutes. So I'm already psyching myself out. I'm like, oh my gosh, I'm going to play on the biggest stadium in tennis. I did a warm up 20 minutes ago. I'm like, not really
the warm up.
I'm not mentally or physically prepared for this match. So I'm just going out there. And then, you know, we did our courtside interview, and then, like you said, I was wearing a patch, and the patch apparently was too big, or they put it on wrong. And so I had to go run off the court, use the change room, and put on a different top. So I was just going into the match all out of sorts. And I was just like, and from that point on, honestly, I think my whole pre-match stuff lasted longer than the actual match. So it was not my best performance, I would say. And yeah, it was fairly quick.
All I remember is you running back onto the court, and most people, you know, this happens. You got to go change your shirt or maybe go to the bathroom. You come back out, you kind of sit down, take a sip of water. You kind of bring your heart rate back down. You get yourself back focused. You ran back on the court, got your racket, ran back to the baseline, ran and got a ball from the ball kid, turned around and served within about 35 seconds. And I'm sitting there courtside going, oh, this is going to be an ugly start. And I think you kind of double folded the first point. And I thought,
100%. So yeah. I was like, oh my God, they're waiting for me. This is my first time on a stadium. Oh my God, I can't be late. I don't know what to do. I was freaking out. I was like, holy shit. Yeah,
it was a quick match. But the good thing is, flip to a couple years later. Okay. Yeah. And you make that run to the US Open semifinal. When you walked onto the court for that match, because for me, that was the match of the tournament. You know, when you walked onto that court, first of all, take me to the perspective of not having a crowd there during that year. And if that actually helped you a little bit, because you're one player that I've said publicly that I think it helped, because you were starting to get really good as a tennis player, starting to really believe in yourself, and then not sort of having the crowd expectation on you, I think helped you find the best Jenny Brady out there. But take me through that maturation of, you know, a couple of years before and being like, oh my God, this is all too much for me, to, hey, I'm here to stay. So take me through that match.
Yeah. I mean, I think I agree. The whole crowd thing, I mean, our first tournament back in Lexington, I won that and there was no crowd. And then leading into the US Open, having no crowd, I just felt like I was hyper-focused on every single point in the matches. And I was also so hungry to just compete again because it had been so long and I was training so hard on my own here in Orlando. And I knew I put in the work. So I had a lot of confidence in myself and my game and my fitness, everything. And I think it kind of showed that I was putting in a lot of work during that time off. And but I think that match, absolutely. If you even ask Naomi that, I'm sure she would say that was probably one of the best matches she's ever played too. I mean, it was just such high quality from the beginning until the end. It was just an unfortunate tiebreak for me in the first set. I did not play a good tiebreak at all. And I had a couple unforced errors, but then it was a good second set. And then the third set, she just broke me once. But yeah, I mean, almost every point was very, very high quality. It was 100% better that match than the match we played in the finals in Australia. I think both of us honestly didn't play good at all. I think she served really well in that match with the US Open. That's one thing that I felt a lot of pressure on was when I was serving, I felt like I really had to play almost not a perfect game, but close to perfect game with a lot of first serves, high first serve percentage and like aggressive from the very beginning because I felt her pressure when she was serving. So that was huge for me in the second set to get the break at 4-3, I think it was. And then, it was a really, really high quality match and just kind of showed the improvements that I made 3 years later from 2017 to 2020. Yeah.
Was the subconscious Jenny and the conscious Jenny on the same path in that semi and also the final, the Aussie? Or were they still battling each other?
In the final, she was battling herself bad. But in the semi, like, I wasn't thinking ahead, wasn't, you know, thinking about any of it. I just wanted to win the match. Like, but that final, I was actually so more disappointed in myself after the semi because I played such a good match. And I was like, gosh, if I played that good, like, how did I not win? And, I mean, tennis is just a matter of inches, like a couple points here and there can make a huge difference. So, I mean, when people say play every point like it's your last, like, I think every point does matter. And that's kind of the perspective that I had sort of taken over the last couple of years, just playing every single point the same, you know, whether I'm up 40 love or down 40 love. I think, you know, just trying to win every single point, it makes a huge difference. Because there's games where, you know, where I'm out of it. And then all of a sudden, you know, I end up winning it. And then I'm looking back at that match and I'm like, holy shit, if I didn't like stay in there and believe in it, like I probably would have lost the match instead of winning 2-2. Like it's a huge difference. And, but yeah, that Australian Open final, I went into the match and I was like, I'm not ready. I'm not ready to be a Grand Slam champion. Like, not that I don't want it, but I was like, I didn't know what to expect. And I was like, oh my gosh, it's just all happened so fast. Yeah. Making my first Grand Slam semifinal to then making my first Grand Slam final right away. I was like, wow, like, I don't know if I'm ready yet. But let me tell you what.
If you could go back, or if you could be that person, like this is what happens when you get into coaching, right? Not yet, Jenny. There's a long way to go yet, but
no, not really.
You go back and say to Jen Brady in the Australian Open the day before or maybe even the morning before, what would you tell yourself now?
Oh, that I'm ready, to hold the trophy, to be a Grand Slam champion. Just play your game, believe in it, and just have fun out there. I think, you know, every single one of the matches that I played, I may have not played my best tennis, and that's also important too, that you don't have to play your best, but you just have to find a way. You have to find a way to just grind and hang in there at any moment. You know, the match can shift, you know, the opponent can get a little bit nervous serving for it, and then you kind of capitalize on that. And also just being aware of how they are mentally and physically, just kind of paying attention to that, to the other side of the court as well. So yeah, I would tell myself just go out there and fucking win it.
Like, I love it. Good. I'm going to remind you of that the next time you're in a final, because you will be one day. Isn't it funny to think that you played Naomi like in the middle of nowhere, Texas, in some challenger? I know that you guys played like first round. Isn't it
funny?
But did you think about when you think about the match in Texas against Naomi, were you like, yeah, she's going to be number one in the world one day and I'm going to play her in a Grand Slam final?
No. I was like, oh my God, I just have to put two balls in the court and she like misses. I was like, oh my gosh. She hit the ball so hard though, but I was like just running side to side for literally two balls. And I was like, yeah, this is easy. Like I just have to make the ball and like put it in the court and she's going to miss.
Well, she's improved her ability to make the ball.
I'd say she's improved a little bit.
So unfortunately, Jenny, you know, when you're having this incredible run, bang. Terrible injury, plantar fascia issues, foot issues, probably overtrained when you had them, because this is, unfortunately, we tennis players, you know, or athletes in general get injured and they just keep pushing, right? They just keep pushing through because it's like they can do it and you don't want to lose 6 months or you don't want to lose a year. Go through that a little bit, just quickly with the injury and where you're at now.
Yeah. So started having pain in my heel and during Miami Open, didn't really think anything of it, you know, like it was just a little bit here and there, and then went over to Europe for the clay season. And then, you know, after my first round match in Stuttgart the next day, I was like, oh my gosh, like I remember I was going to the gym with Daniel and we started like jogging and I was like, I can't do this, like I can't even, like I was like, I'm in so much pain. And I just kept pushing it, played at Rome, played a match, ended up retiring, and then went to Roland Garros. So I was like, okay, I'm not going to play, you know, I'm going to come here, I'm going to withdraw. Sunday night, I'm like, screw it, I'm going to play. Like, and I told myself, I was like, I'm only going to play, like, but I'm stepping out there and I'm finishing the match. Like, I'm not going to do, you know, it's like, that's why they came up with this lucky loser, you know, 50% prize money, because I was like, okay, you know, I go out there, I play a couple games, I'm not gonna, you know, I'm gonna get fined, and I totally respect that. And ended up winning a round. You know, next day, couldn't really walk, played my second round, won that, and then third round I was playing Coco, and I didn't only just have foot pain at that point, because I was just like compensating with the rest of my body. Like I started having back spasms, I couldn't serve, everything kind of went, and I just had to end up retiring. But yeah, like you said, like I just kept pushing my body and pushing it and pushing it and pushing it. And I never really had like a bad injury like that before. So it's always just been something like, oh, okay, you know, just play through it and it'll go away. And it wasn't one of those. And then ended up skipping the whole grass season, played the Olympics, and then was playing in a tournament in Cincinnati. Was way too soon, still was having a lot of pain. Like I remember practicing and just like crying during practice, and but like always just keeping to myself. Like I'm also not very good. I like to just, you know, push through it, and I'm like, okay, like, you know, you're not weak, you know, just keep playing, like keep playing, you know.
Where do you get that from? Like, where do you get that from?
My dad. My dad, for sure. Yeah, he instilled like a football mentality in me, and
but you know, in football they just inject a little like steroid in there and go and play this game, and they have like a 6-year professional career pretty much. That's like a max. Yeah,
I know, but you know, you live and learn. And I was playing a match against Ostapenko, my second round match, and I ended up tearing my plantar fascia. And while this started going on, like back in July, I started having a little bit of knee pain. And so, because I was compensating so much, went to the US Open with a torn plantar fascia, didn't know it was torn, didn't get an MRI, and was having pretty bad knee pain. And I remember I was like practicing, I was hitting some serves and I felt like a crack in my knee. And I was like, oh my God, ouch. And ended up getting an MRI and they were like, okay, you have a stress fracture. So I pulled out of US Open. Funny enough, I was supposed to play Emma Raducanu first round. So
that's right.
Yeah. So,
she's set for life because of you pulling out. Hey.
Yeah. You're welcome, Emma. You're welcome. You can thank me later. And I've been rehabbing both my injuries, been out since August. My foot's feeling pretty good. My knee ended up having, it was a lot worse than expected. It was, so I have a cartilage piece that like kind of broke off. So I, a couple weeks ago, I had surgery and they went in there and scoped it and cleaned it up. And so, yeah, I was hoping to be on court 6 weeks post-surgery, but, you know, the idiot inside of me.
Always go a little.
Well, I also was kind of pushing it on my own. I was doing some stuff on my own. I like to test my injuries and not that I made anything worse, but I've kind of given myself a little bit of a setback because I wanted to, because I was just going mad. Like it's been so long since I've played and, you know, really like done anything, you know,
so
like push myself physically. So
I mean, the ultimate question is, what would you tell yourself a year and a half ago? And I think the answer is just, you know, when your body's screaming at you, take the time.
Yeah, when your body's screaming at you, stop. Like, I would probably be playing. I mean, probably, you never know, but I could have prevented it from getting this bad if I had just listened to my body in the first place and shut it down for, you know, a couple weeks, a month. Listen to my body before, you know, just trying to keep pushing it and pushing it and pushing it.
Is that the, I think, the lasting legacy of someone like Ash Barty, who you were good buddies with, played doubles with on the tour from time to time? And, you know, Ash is pretty similar to you, a total tomboy, can play any sports, you know, shy, but yet easygoing. You're very similar in that respect. Is it the legacy of Ash to say, if you don't want to play, don't play. If you're injured, don't play. You've got plenty of time on your hands. Obviously Ash is, you know, retired now, but don't you feel like, you know, her not playing throughout that whole pandemic year because she just didn't want to travel and deal with all that quarantine? Do you think something in that is to help other players say, you've got plenty of time, like calm down, like you've still got so much time, Jen, on your hands. And so hopefully you're taking that to heart.
Yeah, in the moment, it's really tough to think. It's tough to think, you know, oh my gosh, I'm missing one tournament. But even then, like, you don't have to play every single week. It's absolutely draining mentally and physically. The tennis season is almost 11 months long. So there's plenty of tournaments to play. And I think it's also being smart with how you schedule your tournaments, how you schedule practice, giving yourself time to rest. I also never took, you know, that last year and a half, I was a little bit of a Nazi. Like, I just kept going and going and going, and it, no wonder my body was just so broken down. I mean, to even just get to tear your plantar fascia is like, it's very tough to do. And to get a stress fracture in your knee and cartilage damage at the same time is very hard to do. So it's something that obviously,
especially at your age.
Yeah, exactly. So it kind of just, my body was just telling me, just slow down. Like, don't, why are you doing so much? And I didn't listen to it. And then, you know, it just got to that point. So I saw something, you know, Christy Yon shared something with me, like a video. And it was like, there was this former athlete who she retired, and she was just so used to going to the gym and just grinding and leaving, like feeling like she, like, is exhausted and just, you know, accomplished everything that she wanted to accomplish, did so much and just was used to like torturing herself and torturing her body. And I was like, oh my gosh, that's how I feel. That's how I felt. I was like, that's not normal. You know, I mean, it is like, you do have to push yourself and push your body, but to a certain point, like to a certain point where it's like, okay, I'm not getting injured. I don't have pain. Yes, you can be sore. You can feel tired, but to a point where you have pain, and if you keep going and going and going and the pain gets worse and worse, then you have an injury. And that's when you kind of have to be like, okay, let's slow it down here. Let's take it easy.
Are you at all not scared, but I guess worried or scared a little bit to like go to that threshold? Because I mean, I know how hard it is and how much training has to go into being a great tennis player. I mean, these points are getting longer, the matches are getting longer, the players are getting better. Is there any part of you that's a little bit trepidatious about pushing yourself to that extreme again?
No. If anything, it's like keeping people are like preventing me from like pushing myself. Like 2 days post-surgery, I was like getting on the assault bike and like trying to like push myself like 80%. And you know, I didn't tell anyone. And then I'm telling people now, like telling the doctor, and they're like, what are you doing? Like, you know, no wonder your knee is like not recovering. Like, you can't be doing that shit. Like, and I'm just like, yeah, but like, I have to get better. Like, you know, I have to be ready. Like, you know, like if I want to come back, like if it knocks off 2 weeks, and they're like, no, you're only like giving yourself setbacks. And I'm like, oh, okay. So no, I'm not afraid of going there. It's more of like listening to my body. The only thing I'm scared of is like, I'm not afraid of it.
Good. I think the lesson here, Jen, is sometimes listen to people that might know a little bit more than you when it comes to actually the way the body works. That's all. That's all I'm saying.
Yeah, I know. I don't really know how it works. I just know how to do what I'm told and more.
Well, so. No, you don't do what you're told, because the doctor told you probably not to do that. But anyway, yeah. Story.
Yeah, you're right. You don't listen, I guess.
Other than the competing part, what do you miss about being on tour?
I miss seeing everyone every single week. All my friends are on tour. I mean, being home in Orlando, I'm like so bored. There's nobody here. The only people who, like when Caroline Dolhide comes back, like, you know, the second she comes back, I'm like, hey, what are you doing? And she just wants to chill, and I'm like, oh, or Maddie. And yeah, it's just, I miss like seeing people. I miss the competition. I miss the training. I miss, you know, feeling like waking up and feeling exhausted, or like, yeah, like feeling like, oh, okay, today I'm doing this, and then at the end of the day, like I feel like I got better. So like I just miss like the process, really. Yeah, that's one thing. Yeah, besides the competing, obviously.
What's the belief system and the belief in you once you're healthy and you're back? And hopefully, it sounds like to me that maybe the coming out of Jenny Brady again might be in the US Open swing. Is that?
Yeah, that is my absolute goal. That's my goal. And the doctor told me if I need to do anything more stupid, I'm going to have another setback. So I'm listening now. Yeah, that's 100% my goal, is to start the US series. And oh man, I'm like, so looking forward to it, but I know it's not going to be easy. That's going to be probably the hardest thing for me, is to know that I'm not going to just, I mean, you never know, but I'm not going to come back and win my first tournament back. And I mean, you never know though. So, but yeah, I know it's not going to be easy. It's going to be a grind, even just getting back on court, getting back, you know, physically, you know, like just getting back into tennis shape, into playing shape. It's going to be tough, but I'm like so looking forward to blood, sweat and tears, baby.
All right, Jenny, last couple of questions. Like coaching wise, for you, what's the most important, like you try and help develop sometimes coaches into understanding how important it is to help players in certain ways, whether it be emotionally, physically, their game plans, structure on the practice court, all of those things is what a coach is. You need a coach for. What are the attributes, you know, that are that you would like to pass on to like people out there that are listening, maybe that want to go into coaching or are looking for a coach for their kids?
I would say that the coach and the player have to have the same goal. They have to believe and want the same things, because I think it motivates each other. And also you start to believe in yourself a little bit more as a player when the coach believes in you. And I think that's really important, because in those moments, it's about the tennis, but it's also mental. Like I'm watching a lot of these tournaments and I'm seeing a lot of mental shifts on the court, and I'm like, oh my gosh, yeah, you know, I can see it right there. You know, if they don't win this point, it's like all hell breaks loose. So I think it's just knowing and believing that regardless of the score, regardless of the points, when you look up at your box and you see someone there, you're like, they believe in me. Like I need to believe in myself. So I think that's really important. And then also just having the structure on court, the practices, you know, having a game plan, having utilizing your weapons, making your weapons better, but also recognizing they recognize your weaknesses and they're not afraid to point those out. So I think because players can name weaknesses of every player, you know, and I think, you know, if the coach doesn't know that, I don't think then that's the right fit. I think that they have to recognize the player's weakness and make that better, and then also make their strengths better. So I think just kind of like developing their game and then also helping them believe in themselves.
All right, go back to being 20, Jenny. What would you tell your 20-year-old self?
You're a lot smarter than you think you are. You can play tennis better than you think you can, and it's just a matter of time before you know good things happen.
Wow, look at you getting all philosophical and old. You're old. What are you, 26 now?
27, like 7 days ago.
Oh, that's right. You're a co-Aries. High five on that one, my friend.
Yeah.
Yeah, go to the Aries. A lot of great tennis players were Aries, my friend. Jenny, I mean, I could talk to you for hours and hours, but I'm just really happy that we got to spend a little bit of time with you today. And I can speak for a lot of people, not only in the television industry, coaching industry, other players. Man, we cannot wait to have you back because you're missed out on tour, my friend.
Yeah, no, I can't wait to be back. I can't wait.
Yeah, and I can't wait to see you 5 minutes before your introduction time on Arthur Ashe Stadium in the near future.
Yeah, me too. I'll be a different person. Don't you worry.
Yeah. No, super focused now, super focused. But Jenny, great job over the last like couple of years. I know you're going to be back. Trust in the process, my friend. Trust in the process. You'll be back and you'll be kicking everyone's ass again with that monster serve and monster forehand. So trust it.
Yeah, I will.
All right, Jenny. Thanks for joining me, my friend. I miss you out there, so we'll see you soon.
Yeah, thanks.
Do the rehab.
Yes.
I do. All right, buddy. Thanks.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
When you drive a vehicle so reliable it's backed by a 10-year, 100,000-mile limited warranty, you stop thinking about what you can't do and start doing what you never thought possible. Visit your local Kia dealer today to see what you're capable of in a vehicle that inspires confidence around every corner. Kia. Movement that inspires.
Call 800-333-4KIA for details. Always drive safely. Limited inventory available. Warranties include 10-year, 100,000-mile powertrain and 5-year, 60,000-mile basic. Warranties are limited. See retailer for details.